Lecture 5, How Language Changes Meaning and Order.
In the past lectures, we've seen how language changes in terms of sounds and in terms of how new pieces of grammar are built. We've seen how language wears away and builds back up at the same time. In this lecture, I want to look at some other things that happen when a language changes, because these are more of the kinds of things that have happened to turn the first language into today's 6,000. So this time, what we want to look at is how words' meanings change over time, and that's apart from grammaticalization. Words' meanings can change in different ways. And we also want to look at word order, because that varies in languages a lot more than we might think just looking at French and Spanish and German, and it has a lot to do with how one language becomes another one, or how one language can become 6,000. So the first part is going to be about meaning. Linguists and philosophers often call this semantics, and so we could say that we're talking about semantic change. Now, as far as semantic change goes, it helps to understand it by thinking of a relatively present-day example. So, there was an old radio show, the Jack Benny Show, and this is a random example. I'm just kind of pulling this out of my head. At one point, the band leader on the show, whose name was Phil Harris, who was kind of a randy fellow, is talking to his wife, who was Alice Faye, who was a singer and movie star at the time. And at one point, and it's sometime in the 40s, he says, "Come on, baby, admit it. Nobody makes love better than me, huh?" And that's on the radio show. Now, to the modern ear, that's a little shocking. It almost sounds like he's talking about something very intimate. You wouldn't expect that on a national radio show in the 1940s. And, of course, that's not what he meant. As late as the 1940s, the term make love actually meant just, perhaps, kissing, or even just dropping a handkerchief in front of someone or coming on to them. But it didn't have the particular meaning that it does now. The meaning of make love has changed gradually over the years, so it was different even for our grandparents. That is a kind of process that happens to all kinds of words in any language over time. And you can imagine that if you're dealing with more than a few decades or a half century, then you can see a great deal of considerable turnover. So we often, in the present tense, are a little bit uncomfortable seeing how the meanings of words change. We feel that there's a meaning set in the dictionary, and then to the extent that usage starts to drift away from this, something wrong has happened. That's a natural feeling. But we gain some perspective on that when we look at what has happened to a great many words in a language over time. And so the process is often one that we could call semantic drift. And this refers to the simple fact that the meaning of a word, the correspondence between a word and what real-world entity or process it's linked to, tends to drift over time. It can drift in many directions. Often it seems almost random, although from one point to another there's always a kind of logical connection. But this is something that happens to words. Language is messy. Here's an example of this. The word silly. The word silly to us means foolish, and it's a very ordinary word. But what's interesting is that in earlier English, silly just meant blessed. In Old English, it meant that somebody was blessed. And for those of you who know German, you'll remember the word selig, which is S-E-L-I-G. It's the same root, and selig means blessed in German. So there was selig in German, and that's blessed, and then in English there was silly, and that meant blessed. They were cognates. But something happened to our word silly in English based on a series of steps. So as late as 1400, you can find tokens of English in which silly still means blessed, and to imagine it meaning what we think of as silly would make the sentence make no sense. And so, for example, in 1400, one quotation from English is, in modern pronunciation, "Silly art thou, holy Virgin Mary." And nobody would call the Virgin Mary silly, most likely. They mean that she's blessed. Now, what happens is that words drift in their meaning. So, as it happens, if you're blessed, then chances are that you're innocent, or at least it implies that. And so, by the time we get well into the Middle Ages, the word silly means innocent. And so you get sentences such as in 1470, "Silly Scotland that of help has great need." Certainly not foolish Scotland. No particular reason why it would be blessed Scotland. You might think that Scotland was blessed, but really what this means in the context is that Scotland is innocent. It's a country that has a subordinate, it's a region that has a subordinate relationship to England, particularly in this time, and therefore silly Scotland, innocent Scotland, Scotland that didn't do anything. But this drifting keeps going. There's no reason why it would only be in one step. If something is innocent, then it tends to elicit compassion. And so there's a meaning of deserving of compassion that comes along. By 1633, you see silly used in sentences like, "Thou only art the mighty God, but I a silly worm." Now, this is a rather lofty kind of context, and so to call oneself a kind of a ding-dong worm would not fit the tone. What the silly meant was, please have compassion upon me, kind of like Scotland. And so, I am a silly worm. And so, then, the fact is that if you deserve compassion, and this is something which is a great problem in human affairs, there's a fine line between deserving compassion, eliciting compassion, and seeming weak. And as a result, by the 1600s, you have a weak meaning for silly. And then there's a fine line between weak and being kind of a dingbat, and hence our meaning for silly. So step by step, a word that meant blessed now means foolish. And at no point did anybody notice some sort of major shift going on. It went step by step, generation by generation. And so this means that Shakespeare can throw us sometimes in his use of the word silly. For example, in The Two Gentlemen of Verona, which dates to 1591, at one point Valentine says, "I take your offer and will live with you, provided that you do no outrages on silly women or poor passengers." Now, today we hear it as kind of some sort of knock on women, and an actor might render it that way. It implies some sort of residual sexism in this arcane character. Shakespeare didn't mean that. He actually meant that the women deserved compassion, that they deserved help, just like the poor passengers. It was a rather nice sentence on silly women and poor passengers. Because of semantic drift over time, and there's certainly been quite a bit of time between Shakespeare and us, we find little false friends like that. So silly has been through quite a trip, and it is a typical example of how words evolve in terms of their meaning through time. So that's an example of semantic drift. Nice is another word like that. You will read in older sources, and even today in residual expressions, nice used to mean fine. So, for example, let's not make nice distinctions. We might kind of just let that go by in our heads, but our core meaning for nice is pleasant, well-intended, socially companionable. So what then is a nice distinction? That goes back to the original meaning of nice, which is that something is subdivided finely. So then you have niceties, and you might think that niceties such as an antimacassar or some sort of sauce on your asparagus is a nicety because, well, it's nice. But that's not really what it means. It's actually something fine. You might want to just eat your asparagus steamed and it's just sitting there. You might want to put something on your asparagus, and some people would think that was kind of pretentious, but that's a finer distinction. That's more specific. You don't want just any old food. You want the asparagus with the hollandaise sauce. It's a nicety. So we preserve it there. Reading Jane Austen or reading through Middlemarch, you can see examples of nice used in that way of making fine distinctions. The word has since evolved, and because those fine distinctions often do create a positive feeling, it is kind of nice. And so now we have that meaning of nice. It didn't used to be that way. So that's what words do. And of course, imagine not just a word, but a whole language full of words with all or most of them undergoing this kind of shift. That's what a language does through time. So you have the first language, then as you get to the 6,000, a lot of the difference between those 6,000 among themselves, and also the difference between the 6,000 and the first one, is due to the fact that words do this, whether we like it or not. There is also, more specifically, something called semantic narrowing. And semantic narrowing is what happens when words develop more specific meanings than the ones that they start out with. This often happens. And so, for example, meat in Old English meant all food. And so meat could refer to something sweet. Meat could refer to a gumball. They didn't have gumballs, but you take my point. That's what meat meant. As time went by, meat came to refer to animal flesh, and that just happened. And as usual, at the margins of the language, the old form survives in some way. So, for example, sweet meat is fruit and candy. It is not horse meat and lamb. But we think to ourselves, well, why is it meat? And then we get on with our lives. But the reason is because that word formed when meat could be anything that you put into your mouth and ate. Then there's semantic broadening, on the other hand. Semantic broadening is when a word becomes more general than what it used to refer to. So the Old English word bird, which was actually brid, only referred to young birds. And so it was kind of like our birdie to the extent that it implies a young bird. And then the word for birds in general was Vogel. And for German fans out there, that is like German's Vogel. And so, again, German and English were more akin in the past than they are now in terms of things like this. As it happened, brid, their word for bird, semantically broadened to refer to all birds, and Vogel became fowl, which refers today only to game birds, or if anything is a rather precious word for bird. And so that's a semantic broadening. So words are going through that kind of process all the time. And as a result, when you look at the vocabulary that our language consists of, what we can see is the endless products at this particular point in time of this sort of thing happening in millions of mouths over a great many years. So we could even trace it back. Proto-Indo-European, which we'll learn about more shortly in the series, is the language that was the parent to not only English and German and its friends, but also French and Spanish and Italian and the other Romance languages and Russian and Polish and Bulgarian and the other Slavic languages. Most of the languages of Europe trace back to an ancestor that linguists call Proto-Indo-European. We only can reconstruct what it must have been like, but we're pretty confident about certain things. And one thing that we know about Proto-Indo-European is that there was a word in it, bear, which meant to carry or to bear children. The core meaning was to carry. It was technically a root because Proto-Indo-European, like Latin, like Spanish, had endings. And so bear wouldn't have occurred alone. There would have been I bear, you bear, etc. But the root was bear. Bear comes down to English in a wide range of meanings, but not just in this meaning of to bear children, and certainly not in terms of to carry. It's there, but it's disguised in a way because it's undergone semantic drift of all kinds, not to mention narrowings and broadenings. So, for example, we bear a nuisance because toleration is a kind of carrying. And so there's an inference there that has come to be part of the language. The bear root also goes through sound changes. So remember, this is always happening too, along with the meaning change. And so what one bears is not a bearden, but it's a burden. And so that burr comes from this original bear. Then there's a narrowing. Some people would argue that to give birth is something of a burden. And so there you have birth. The B-I-R is from bear. So you've got, I'll bet you never thought about the fact that that T-H is a suffix. You've got warm, warmth. You've got sloth, sloth, sloth. That's where that came from. And then you have foul and filth. Those came from, those are related in that way. You have bear, you have birth, and then sound changes it to birth. And so that's how that word works. Then there was what bear went through when sometimes it kludged onto other words. And this is something which we've seen is very common, and so there's no exception with bear. Often, Proto-Indo-European speakers would combine bear with this other verb, enk. Enk meant to get to reach. And so if you bear enked something, so to speak, then you carried something with the aim of getting it somewhere. In other words, this was bringing. And notice that if you say berenk together, and you imagine what happens when people are saying berenk, bring, 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 pretty soon you've got this word bring. Bring starts out as these two words, and it comes together. That's from berenk. And you'd never think about the fact that bring has this little piece in its skeleton, which is the same root that makes birth and burden or even bear. But that's the way it worked. And of course, it's not that bear is some sort of trick word. This is just normal. This is what happens to words over time. So berenk became bring, just like all one became alone, as we saw in a previous lecture. So that happened to bear. Now then, we can pull the camera back again and remember that bear originates in Proto-Indo-European, although we can assume that it goes back further than that, but for our purposes it's there. Now, what happened in English was one thing, but bear also percolated into all the other languages that Indo-European involves. It bears mentioning, for example, that Indo-European, and this is a preview because we're going to talk more about this pretty soon, is a family that extends across most of Europe, with just a few exceptions. Then we come through the Fertile Crescent region, and it is most of the languages of Iran, and it carries us all the way through to India here. So, Indo-European is a big family. Notice that as the world goes, it's just one of a great many, and on this map, only the families are marked in pretty colors that we're going to discuss in this series. But the world is covered with families. There is quite a mess of them, for example, here in New Guinea and in Australia, and don't even get me started on South America. So, this orange spread is just one of many, but we're talking about Indo-European. And what happened in English, of course, only happened in this one lonely little place. So what about in these other places? An example would be what happened with Latin. And so Proto-Indo-European has bear. In Latin, for various reasons, that root changed into, for example, ferre, which means to carry. And ferre, that happened in Latin. Then later on, English borrowed a lot of words from Latin. And so we've got all of these words with the children of ferre in them, which trace back to bear, just like our bear words do. And so transfer and prefer, those are from ferre, which goes back to bear. And those involve carrying mostly in a transparent way, so transferring. As far as prefer, the meaning of the word has changed so much that we can only figure it out by tracing it back, and prefer is just a word to us. It doesn't involve carrying. And then there is fertile, and once again, that's carrying, so you can bear a child, you can be fertile. Who knew that when you say bear and fertile, in a way, you're saying the same word? It's because of how languages not only change within, but the way they borrow from each other. Greek, which is another branch of Indo-European, inherited bear as pherein, and then you have pheromone, you have paraphernalia, which you carry around, you have amphorae, which is a pretentious word for bottles, and it's because you carry things in bottles, so amphorae. So, this is a common tendency that one sees in language change, and it's something that makes the first language into several others, and in a less tidy, but I think in some ways more interesting fashion than we might always intuitively think. And that is that there is always semantic change. Words' meanings tend to drift around. At no point is there no systematic meaning within a language, but at all points the words' meanings are changing. So that's semantic change, and then while that's going on, you also see changes in word order. And what I mean by word order is a concept that we want to lock into our heads. There are many languages in the world, of which English is one, that use what linguists call SVO order. And what that means is subject, verb, object. Now in school, we probably were exposed to the subject predicate paradigm. So you've got half of this in your head already, subject. Linguists talk about predicates, but not as much as they talk about two elements of the predicate, which is the verb and the object. Of all the things you can think of that are interesting in a language, linguists have this fetish about the object. And so subject, verb, object. So the boy kicked the ball. And that is an SVO sentence. English is an SVO, subject, verb, object, language. If you are an English speaker, and sometimes even if you are just a logician, nothing seems more logical than to start with the subject, then mention what it did, and then mention what it did, whatever it was doing, to. But as it happens, SVO is not the most common word order in the world. Generally, most often, by a hair or two, a language is going to be SOV, which is a language where you have subject, object, verb. So for us, we think of German as kind of cute in tending to put the verb at the end. And so the boy has his first alcoholic drink had, or something like that. And we think, well, how quaint. Actually, how normal. Many languages are that way. So in Turkish, for example, if Hasan buys an ox, if Hasan bought an ox, then Hasan the ox bought. Hasan öküzü aldı. And so Hasan did not buy the ox. If you're a Turk and you've never been exposed to English, the weirdest thing about English at first to you is this business of putting the verb in the middle of the sentence. And that's true across a great many places in the world. If you're a linguist and you are studying an undocumented language, you are as open to it being SOV, subject, object, verb, as it being SVO. If anything, SVO is kind of the boring one. It's kind of, we know, we have that from English. If it's going to be interesting, it's going to have a different word order. That's part of the fun. Then there are languages where the verb comes first. For example, Welsh and its Celtic relatives, like Irish Gaelic, Scots Gaelic, Breton, are verb-first languages. And so they are VSO, as linguists call them, verb, subject, object. That's also true of languages of Polynesia, like Samoan and Tongan. And this is very ordinary in these languages to have the verb come first. Those of you with the book can see the Welsh example with Alan seeing the dog. It used to be that it was thought that still there were limits. If you've got S, V, and O, then there's six possible combinations. And it used to be thought that one of them that you would never find, it was thought just to be too wacky, would be OVS, object, verb, subject. One thing to put the verb first, but object, verb, subject, it was thought unlikely. But there is a language in South America, and it's not the only one, which was discovered, where that actually is the default order. One of them has a nice name, Hishkaryana, and it's spoken by a very small group of people. And if you have an ordinary sentence, like the man took the canoe, then it's canoe took person. And so kanawa yano toto is canoe took person. And that's the normal way that they speak. If a Hishkaryana-speaking monolingual were brought into quote-unquote civilization, then one of the first things they'd have to learn is that people in civilization talk backwards. And that's because word order can be like that. Now, what's important about word order is that it's also central in how languages change, just like how meaning changes. So these word orders tend to change in languages over time. There is a minor debate as to whether or not the first language would have been SOV or SVO. By my reckoning, the jury is out. Either one could be plausible. But we know that languages change their word order over time. And so whatever the first word order was, there are now certainly a great many languages that have a different word order. For example, Old English had a word order system similar to German's. And so if you were learning Old English, then one thing you would have to get used to is that our good old-fashioned meat and potatoes SVO order was only one option, and that you pretty much had to master the German way of putting things together. So something along the lines of he had seen the boy would very likely be he had the boy seen in Old English. That's because, again, English and German were more similar back in English's earlier days. Biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew are essentially different languages. One reason that they are is that Biblical Hebrew put the verb first. Modern Hebrew is SVO, like modern English. The word order changed over time. Now, one little factoid. Often a linguist says that languages can be of any word order and the order changes over time. There is a little more. There's a little mystery that comes up every now and then, which is that watching a language go from SOV to SVO is common. So very often a language that puts its verbs on the end ends up putting its verbs in the middle. If from an ethnocentric perspective, it is common to see languages go from SOV to what we can't help but process as normal. And there are even some analyses that suggest that there is something normal about SVO and that everything else is something that might happen but is somehow not stable. And the fact is that seeing a language go from SVO to SOV, a language starting to put its verbs on the end, is very, very rare, except in situations where people who speak an SVO language for one reason or another start speaking an SOV language to the point that the SOV language starts to affect this original one. So then you will see that kind of change. But if the people are just going on about their business and there's no kind of heavy influence of some outside language upon the language, languages that are SVO have a way of not becoming SOV. There are various answers as to why that would be, but it's not, none of them are firm, and it's kind of a mystery at this point. So that's just an observation. But there are also languages that have no set word order at all. The classic example of this is a language called Walloperi in Australia. And in Walloperi, you could have a sentence, "The small child is chasing the dog." And there's really no order at all. You can have those elements in any order that you want. You could say, dog is chasing child small. You could say, chasing is dog the child small. You can even say, child is chasing small the dog, with the small and the child separated from each other. And this is just the way these people talk. It's not a personality trait. There's nothing loopy about the Walloperi speakers. It's just that their language does this. One thing that helps it along is that Walloperi is a language kind of like Latin, where you have suffixes to indicate whether something is an object or, depending on how you put it, a subject. And so you can get away with shuffling things around because it's always clear what contribution it's making to the sentence. It's not even that simple, though, because there are some languages in the world, I'm aware of a few in Southeast Asia where they don't have these kinds of endings, and yet word order is very, very free. The fact of the matter is that context can take care of quite a bit, and to have an actual word order is nice, but in many situations it's not absolutely necessary, especially in the context of running speech where it's always tied to a context as opposed to something that's disembodied on the page. So, we've seen that semantic change is crucial in how languages go from stage A to stage B and eventually become new languages. And we've seen that word order is not as static as we might think, that the order of words is always changing in most cases, and that there are a great many different kinds of orderings that there can be. And so what this means is that when we talk about language in this course, to recapitulate what I think is an important point, we don't only mean the words. The words are great, and of course, structure without the words would be a rather tiresomely abstract concept. That would not be a useful language. But when we talk about language, the words is one thing, but the sounds and the grammar and meanings are just as important, because neat things happen to those things too. And these things are always changing. So, of course, part of what happens to a language is that words drop out and words come back in. But in a way, that's kind of ordinary. So there was a medieval instrument called a shawm. We don't have shawms anymore, so big surprise, that word dropped out of the language. There is now something called, what's something that's new? There's electronic messaging. Nobody even 15 years ago would have known what in the world that is. Now we have that new expression because we have that new thing. Okay, that's nice. But what is really interesting is that if you take a word in a language. For one thing, its sounds are always changing. So really, in a way, when I look at a word in a language, I think, especially if it's not a word that exists in a highly written language, a word is kind of in danger in a way. It can't stay the way it is. Things are going to get worn away. Things are going to get distorted. It can't stay that way for long. It's like a cloud blowing through the sky. So the first thing that happens to a word is that if it hangs around, words like get, words like bring, now that it's a combination of two things, who knows what could happen to bring as time went on, the sounds are wearing away. The mountain is being worn away by the winds. Then in the meantime, its meaning is probably going to be distorted over time, and that's just a natural process as words go through time. In the meantime, if it's a concrete word, it may, especially if it's certain a kind of concrete word, change into a grammatical word over time, which is almost always going to involve being heavily eroded phonetically as well. That word might just become a prefix or a suffix as time goes by, like that little word enk to get to in Proto-Indo-European did when it kludged onto bear and became bring. And so what this means is that language, as I've often written, is like a lava lamp, one of those lava lamps from the 1970s. And so it's not that a language is marching towards some kind of ideal. It's not that a language is slowly going to the dogs. A language is like that, the blob in those lamps. And so at one point it's like that, and another point it's like that, then this little thing pulls off, but then it goes and sticks to something else. And at no point would you say, what's going on in the lava lamp now is somehow better than what was going on 10 minutes ago. It's always just variations on the same thing, which was why it was so mesmerizing to watch them for maybe 5 or 10 minutes if you didn't have anything else to do. That is what language change is like, endless morphings. So in the next lecture, we will take a closer look at these sorts of things in a language with which we were once familiar.